This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The trial of former Honolulu Police Chief Louis Kealoha for corruption charges is currently underway. The Honolulu Police Commission previously decided that Kealoha was entitled to a taxpayer-funded attorney. But some members of the Honolulu City Council want to change that. HPR's Ryan Finnerty joins us live here in the studio to explain more. Morning, Ryan.
Good morning, Catherine. And that's right. So today at 3 p.m., City Council member Ron Minor, who chairs the Executive Matters and Legislative Affairs Committee, they will be meeting to vote on a resolution introduced by Councilmember Minor that would challenge the previous decision by the Police Commission to pay the attorney fees for former HPD Chief Louis Kealoha. A little bit of background for those who maybe aren't following it that closely. The former chief is he's scheduled for two separate trials. One, the one that's currently underway, deals with the alleged abuse of his powers as police chief. That's the mailbox case. And the other covers some issues like identity theft, bank fraud, and financial crimes. It's all part of this big federal investigation involving the former chief, his wife, Catherine Kealoha, and that mailbox conspiracy that everybody's probably heard so much about. When the charges against the former chief were unsealed, he had requested that the city provide him with a lawyer to represent his defense or to pay for one that he chose. And he's entitled to that protection under Hawaii state law. There is a law on the books that counties are required to fund the legal defense of any police officer who is accused of wrongdoing while on the job. So back in March, the Honolulu Police Commission, which is the independent oversight board that monitors HPD, voted to approve an attorney for Kealoha in one of the trials, the one that's currently going on, that concerns the abuse of his police powers. And as we said, that trial is currently underway. Louis Kealoha is being represented right now by a federally appointed public defender. So the federal government's paying for that. But the concern is that the police commission's decision could allow the federal government to request reimbursement from the city and county. So that's kind of what spurred Councilmember Minor to introduce this resolution that's being considered today by his committee. What he wants to do is direct the city attorneys, the Office of Corporation Counsel, to challenge the police commission's decision in federal court. And when I spoke to him, this is what he had to say about it.
I do not think that the alleged actions of Kealoha were done in the performance of his official duty as a police officer, which would legally obligate the city to pay for his outside counsel. The criminal indictment against him alleges that he engaged in a conspiracy and coordinated with other police officers in connection with a personal dispute involving his wife and her relatives. And I just don't think that those kinds of alleged actions fall within the scope or meet the standard which would require the city to pay for his attorney's fees with respect to the representation that he's receiving from outside counsel.
So, Catherine, that phrase you heard Ron Minor say, in the performance of his duties, is really the critical issue here. Because as we said earlier, Hawaii police officers who get into legal trouble while on duty are entitled to taxpayer-funded legal representation. And so what happened in this case was the police commission met and they decided that in the conspiracy crime, so that's the one related to the mailbox and the criminal intelligence unit of HPD, that Louis Kealoha was acting in his official capacity as police chief. And their reasoning was that he was doing actions like directing other officers, overseeing surveillance, overseeing an investigation that a police chief would do. He was doing things that he would normally do. And here is Loretta Sheehan. She's a Honolulu attorney and also chair of the police commission. And she explained why they came to that conclusion.
At first blush, when you take a look at it, you think, well, wait a minute, these charges are committing crimes. How can that be in the performance of an officer's duty? That makes absolutely no sense at all. However, that's not really the analysis. The analysis is really, is he charged for acts for something that a police officer does? Is he charged with writing a traffic ticket? Is he charged with making an arrest? Is he charged with being on the job? Is he charged with surveillance? Is he charged with doing something that a cop does? Because if he's charged with that, then the statute requires us to pay for the legal counsel. As police officers, you can do an act in the performance of your duty, and you can do it illegally. You can do it badly. You can do it negligently. You can do it wrongfully. So But if it's an act done in the performance of the officer's duty, then we have to pay for it. So the statute requires that they be given free legal counsel because maybe they didn't do it.
Honolulu Police Commission Chair Loretta Sheehan there. And so you heard their reasoning. In this case, the police commission decided that Louis Kalo has ability to carry out the conspiracy that he is accused of, the alleged crimes, involving other officers from the department derived from his authority as police chief. He wouldn't have been able to do it if he wasn't police chief. And so therefore, he was acting in his capacity as chief for these alleged crimes. It's also worth noting that there are the two trials, and the police commission decided he was not entitled to a taxpayer-funded attorney for the second trial. That's the one involving bank fraud, identity theft, financial crimes. They decided in that case he was acting as a private citizen, not as a police officer, not as the police chief, and so he's on the hook for his own defense on that. And I wanted to kind of get into this issue a little bit more, Loretta Sheehan, so to understand this law and its scope, because as you can imagine, there's a fair amount of interpreting that has to go on. Each case is a little bit different. And so I asked her about the example of a police officer who's arrested for driving under the influence of alcohol while off duty. And here's what she said.
In a case of that, they'd be on the hook for their own defense. But if he's on the job driving around drunk, yeah, we'd probably pay for it. Was he driving around in the performance of his duty? Yeah. Was he drunk? Maybe. But he's driving around in the performance of his duty, so we pay for his lawyer.
So yeah, that was a kind of a striking example to me. And what Loretta emphasized is that when the police commission was interpreting this law, they're not making a judgment on whether the actions of the accused officer were proper or not. They're only deciding if the actions were done in the performance of their duties as a police officer. And then it's left to a court or some type of oversight board to make the decision on whether those actions were proper or not. And that's what you heard her saying in that last clip, was that you can do something as a police officer that's part of your job and do it illegally, but you're still protected under this Hawaii law. And she said that the way they approach this problem is kind of similar to the way an insurance company evaluates whether or not it's going to pay out for a claim. And that in that example, the city and county of Honolulu is the insurance company and the police officer is the client who's paying for insurance. She said they only look at the very narrow scope of the report, exactly what happened. They don't take into account outside events or past things that have gone on with that officer. So it's a pretty narrow judgment. What Ron Manor wants to do is challenge that in court. If his resolution passes today, it will go to the full city council for a vote. If it passes there, it would direct the corporation council to file a lawsuit in federal court challenging the police commission decision. It would then be up for that court to decide whether the police commission ruled correctly. Interestingly, Loretta Sheehan said she has no problem with that. That's how she thinks the system should work. They made their decision. They thought it was the right one. They're totally open to outside review. And if it's overturned, then it will most likely be that the city doesn't pay.
Well, when you talked to Manor, did he give you an indication that there might be, it might get hung up?
He was very confident that he had the support of his fellow council members. He didn't give a specific number, but he said that his colleagues on the city council supported his intent. He thinks they're in line with his opinion on the matter. And so today at 3 p.m., the committee will meet, and that will be sort of the first test of what kind of support this idea has on the council.
Okay, and we'll see what happens. All right, thanks so much, Ryan.
Thank you.
And you can find more on the Kealoha case at hawaiipublicradio.org.
We're in a marketplace in Bangkok, next time on The World, at the intersection of food, language, and a certain taste.
We just don't have a word for it in English, and the word is baht.
Baht. Baht.
I can't explain, she says. Can someone else explain it to this guy?
Sampling new flavors and the words that describe them. It's on The World.
This afternoon at 1.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In our backyard this morning, we've got trains on our minds, and we're testing your knowledge of the days when rail travel was for some ultimate luxury. The subject of today's quiz had a private rail car built for himself, and he earned it. He was, after all, the founder of the railroad. In the 1900s, he had the parlor car number 64 designed for his personal use. It cost a hefty $4,388.24, and it was the showpiece of the Oahu Railway and Land Company. It had a double-sized rear platform surrounded by ornate iron grillwork. Fluted awnings protected our railway magnate and his friends from the harsh sunlight of the Ewa Plain. And the extra-large platform gave passengers a terrific view and allowed them to catch a trade wind breeze as they took it all in. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us the name of the man who founded the Oahu Railway and Land Company? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank Wealth Management, with advisors committed to providing personalized service for clients' planning, investment, and insurance needs. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com.
The news at the Dillingham Ranch on Oahu's North Shore is back on the market came as a surprise to many people. Owners Kennedy Wilson bought the 2,740 acres in 2016 for $26 million. The zoning allows for a 70-lot subdivision with a 2-acre minimum. Critics worry that the farm dwelling units or gentleman farms are nothing more than fake farms. Now, the sale includes the historic lodge as well as the polo fields across the highway. We took time out earlier this month to visit the Dillingham Ranch, acquired by Patriarch Benjamin Dillingham. It was a fundraiser for a Historic Hawaii Foundation in a nod to Historic Preservation Month.
So these ranches themselves encompass, you know, conservation areas just by virtue of the large swaths of land that they're operated on. And the majority of these owners have been really great about cooperating with local municipalities and state governments to preserve not just, you know, the history of ranching, but a lot of Hawaiian history is encapsulated in these ranches, watersheds, forests, and the like. So preserving it not just for today, but hopefully tomorrow as well.
On hand for that event was a descendant of the Dillingham family. Bill White is a Big Island rancher who operates Halekea Farms in Waimea. He flew over to Oahu for an afternoon that included polo ponies and wild peacocks.
Harold Dillingham would be my grand uncle. He married my grand aunt, Margaret, and they had five boys who were dear friends of my mother because they were contemporaries and first cousins. And some of the kids from those five boys became friends of mine. And Kenny Dillingham, who was the son of, I think, Byer Dillingham, came here and ran the cattle ranch for a number of years. And my memory was coming out here and seeing Kenny and him showing me around the ranch and the ranch operation here. That probably was 35 years ago, maybe 40.
And you came over special from the Big Island for this?
Yeah, just because of our relationship with the Dillingham family, and I thought it would be fun to see. My sister spent more time here. Aunt Margaret invited her over here, and she stayed here for a period of time. And actually, when James Michener was writing the book on Hawaii, he was here, and so my sister says I was there with Jimmy.
But you don't remember.
But anyway, that's kind of our little story.
And here's Kirsten Faulkner, the director of the Historic Hawaii Foundation, setting the stage of this historic property.
This is the Dillingham Ranch, which has this rich, wonderful history here in Mokuleia. And we were just very happy to be able to share some of that with friends and members of Historic Hawaii Foundation, members of the community, to come and learn more about this special place in their own backyard.
I'm listening to the peacocks in the background.
We are hearing peacocks. There are chickens running around. We have this grand alley of trees that line the driveway that comes up to the main house. It's got this grand lodge with a separate kitchen wing, a couple of bedroom wings, and then off to the side is the original house, which is known as the dollhouse. Back behind us are some open fields. We have a wonderful view of the Waianae mountain range, and just up the road is the polo field that Dillingham helped start, and it's just an amazing setting with agriculture, history, culture, architecture, all coming together in one place.
And this is Preservation Month.
May is Historic Preservation Month, and we thought this was a great way to help highlight some of the preservation success stories. So this part of the ranch is designated for preservation. The architecture, the landscape, the archaeological sites, as well as just the overall feel of keeping the country country.
Folks don't normally get a chance maybe to come up here, but the current owners have made efforts, I think, to maintain it.
Yes, it's managed as an event center, so it's available for lease and people can come have events here. Our event was done through special arrangement through the owners as a chance to invite community members to come in. Normally, you might come to a wedding here or to a corporate retreat, but it's not normally just open to the public for tours. So this was by special arrangement.
Okay, and so what else does the Historic Hawaii Foundation have going forward?
So this month, as you mentioned, is Historic Preservation Awareness Month, and we are celebrating preservation success stories. So we have our Preservation Honor Awards coming up on May 31st. So that will be a chance to showcase some of the great preservation projects that have occurred over the past year. So that's at the YWCA on May 31st, and there's information at historichawaii.org. So that's happening. On our website, we have different showcases, little blog posts that tell the stories of different preservation projects. There's one up there right now about restoring the stained glass windows at St. Peter's Episcopal Church. There's another one about the 175th anniversary of Oahu Cemetery, which is this year. So people can check in and learn these little tidbits about history and preservation and culture all month long.
And coincidentally, around that same time, we also talk with Kavika Burgess, former Chief Operations Officer of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. He also works with the Hawaiian Islands Land Trust and was just named CEO of Kalona Brands Company, a new agricultural venture on Kamehameha School's land on Oahu's North Shore.
You know, one of the ways I've been working to protect, you know, the most significant natural and cultural resources in Hawaii is, number one, through voluntary land conservation programs, and with the Hawaiian Islands Land Trust in particular, currently serving on the board of advisors, where we work with landowners, with communities to identify and protect, you know, again, the most significant places here in Hawaii containing, you know, our native forests, our historical cultural sites, the places where we can practice and perpetuate our culture. And I think it's a very important program and method for us to be proactive in ensuring that we can protect these remaining places in Hawaii, the places that, you know, provide for the quality of life that we enjoy, the places that contain the essence of Hawaii, you know, the most unique places, the places where our stories and traditions are practiced and perpetuated and where we can practice our culture.
So are there particular areas that are under threat?
There are, right? So, you know, across the islands, you know, just in general, you know, through urbanization, you know, commercial development, we're developing about 10 to 13 square miles of land per decade. And, you know, we have lost, you know, some of our most significant sites, from our heiau to just storied places to some of our, you know, traditional farmlands, both dry land and wetland systems, other sacred sites. And so, you know, these resources are under constant threat from subdivision, urbanization, development. And so the more we can do to identify these places, to preserve, you know, the knowledge, the stories, the traditions there, and then again to work collaboratively with landowners, with, you know, developers, planners, consultants, and communities to find win-win solutions to protect these places is vitally important.
Are there specific sites, I guess, on the different islands that, you know, you can talk about?
Yeah, I guess so. Just speaking for, like, the Hawaiian Islands Land Trust, one of the things that the organization was able to recently do was do a strategic conservation plan. So actually using GIS mapping to identify, you know, the layers of the natural resources, cultural resources on each island. So to actually map out where, you know, again, the cultural sites are, where the native forests are still intact and remain, where some of the most significant agricultural resources, farms and ranches are, and to develop heat maps to prioritize those areas. So, you know, on each island, particularly in the rural districts, there are still a lot of very special places from our coastlines and our beaches. Again, you know, our sacred sites and storied places, even our, you know, again, our working farms and ranches where, you know, they're under pressure of urbanization, of urban sprawl, kind of subdivision development, but the land trusts and communities are working to protect, you know, from coastline areas in particular in Kau on the Big Island and North Kohala. We've been working on several projects to protect the coastlines, you know, Makai of the highway. On Maui, some of the significant taro lands along the windward districts of Maui and the coastlines in Hana. On Oahu, there's a few kind of traditional lo'i and fish ponds remaining on the island that we've been working with. And on Kauai as well, some of the coastlines there. So on each island, we're working with communities and landowners on coastlines, historical cultural sites, and significant, you know, agricultural lands to ensure that they're protected for future generations.
Is there anything that we're working on immediately that might be under threat?
Yeah, well, one project just in particular comes to mind that we've been working on for a little while, the Waikalua fish pond, Waikalua Lokoia, right on Oahu in Kaneohe, you know, dates back to around 1600. And Herb Lee and the Pacific American Foundation have been working for, you know, decades now in managing, restoring, protecting, and educating the area youth and families about the significance of the fish pond, doing science and cultural education there. And we've been working with them to actually acquire the fish pond. It has changed ownership, you know, several times while they've remained kind of as the stewards of the fish pond. And so that's one we've been working on to help them actually acquire the fish pond. And so that it can, they can continue their cultural and educational activities, and the cultural fish pond itself would be protected, you know, into the future.
I think I've been to that one. The efforts of the youth that are out there working on restoring that fish pond is just incredible.
Yeah, it's fantastic. They've been doing a lot of great work over the years, you know, like over 10,000 students and teachers have, you know, contributed, have learned from, benefited from, learned from the fish pond there, you know, and assisted in the stewardship, you know, and lent their mana aloha to the fish pond. And it's definitely a place worth protecting.
Yeah, it's beautiful. The beautiful spot. Anything else you think would be important to underscore as we celebrate Historic Preservation Month and our important sites?
Well, I mean, one of the things we're working on now is, you know, is developing, you know, a regenerative agriculture and food company. And I think being proactive in land uses, sustainable land uses, where we can preserve, protect, and, you know, reutilize where feasible, but celebrate our cultural sites, our historic places, rather than uses that diminish or destroy them, is a much more viable option for us here in Hawaii. So I think being proactive and, you know, working to, again, to restore through, you know, sustainable practices, regenerative agriculture, other uses of these sites and places so that we can perpetuate them for future generations is important.
Okay, and then tell us again the groups that you're associated with.
Kalona Brand Company. So we're it's a regenerative and vertically integrated ag and food company where we're looking to revitalize sustainable agriculture in Hawaii and develop unique Hawaiian agriculturally based food products, and using that as a method to incorporate the restoration, the protection, the preservation of our lands, of our cultural sites, of our history.
That was Kavika Burgess talking with us about how best to preserve large, important tracts of land through agriculture. You can listen back to this story and view images of Dillingham Ranch today at hawaiipublicradio.org. It's now time for our reality check. Honolulu Civil Beats Investigations Editor John Hill joins us this morning. Hi, John.
Hi.
You know, you tackled a child custody story. That is, like, so complex.
It is, yeah. And in this case, it involved a grandmother on the Big Island whose daughter died tragically in a car accident, and she tried to adopt her grandson, but the state said that she couldn't.
And so she ended up suing them.
She is suing them, and she's also been working in family court to try to get some results that way. It's an unusual case in many ways because, in general, the state of Hawaii tries to reunite children with relatives when they can't be with their parents anymore. There have been a number of cases, including ones that went to, for instance, the Hawaii Supreme Court, where the state argued to place children with relatives and was even overruled. But in this case, they took kind of the opposite position.
So tell us what happened.
So what happened was that the woman I'm wrote about today, Deb Goodwin, she lives in the Big Island, and her daughter, Sarah Thurber, suffered from bipolar disorder and had kind of a chaotic life. And had a couple of children, including JJ, was her second child, and was unable to really take care of JJ because of her bipolar disorder and addictive behavior. And Deb, her mother, tried to do what she could to intervene and to take him in, but it was pretty chaotic there, I think. And then Sarah, the daughter, died in a car accident. And right after that happened, Deb Goodwin tried to adopt her grandson, but foster him through the foster system. And she went through the process you have to go through to be approved as having a home that's safe for a child. And she did do that. She says the state didn't tell her that she had been approved to foster him for almost a year and a half. And basically all along the way since then, that happened in 2016, all along the way since then, the state has argued that JJ, her grandson, should stay with this foster family of non-relatives rather than with her.
Now, is she able to see her grandson, though?
She has been able to see her grandson, although at one point the visits were limited to, I believe, once a month. Mm-hmm. I think that she now is able to see him more often, but there were a lot of restrictions on her time with him and that she objected to as well.
And so tell us then about the struggle that she's involved in with the courts, the family court system right now.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of actions in the family court. They're basically deciding who JJ will go with permanently, who will adopt JJ. And family court is very secretive, so I don't really know the details about what's going on there, but it's going on right now. And in the meantime, Deb Goodwin filed a civil lawsuit in circuit court, which is public, in which she argues that basically the state kind of abused its discretion and made a wrong decision here.
I mean, it is a tough case because, like you said, the kind of the whole system tends to be secretive when it comes to family issues. It's not like a civil case, or a criminal case where everything is public record.
That's true, and the state is constrained in what it can say about the case. They don't like to comment, or they feel that they can't comment on pending litigation. So I just got a general statement from the state, but in all the filings that I have seen, I have not seen anything where the state really made an argument for why this child should not be with his grandmother. So I don't know what their reasoning is about that. Maybe that's being played out in family court, and maybe they have reasons that I don't know about, but I haven't seen any. And Deb Goodwin, who I interviewed extensively, says she hasn't been given any.
So what's the next step? When is the next round in court?
Well, the family court actions are going to play out. I'm not sure when they're going to be resolved. In the meantime, there's this civil suit, and the next hearing in that is July 1st. But the state has already argued that the civil suit shouldn't even exist because the family court really has jurisdiction here. Ultimately, the family court has to decide based on a placement for the child based on the child's best interest. And that's the criteria they use, although there have been efforts by the state to make sure that if there's a chance that a child can be placed with a relative, that does happen.
And, I know DHS has come under fire in the past for other cases, a very complex issue. And I know it's tough for the social workers out there because they have such a large caseload to deal with. It's very hard to keep track of. And you're talking about something so important, family bonds and keeping families together.
That's true. And what you say about the caseloads is very true. In fact, there was just some money was appropriated in a recent legislative session to hire more workers in the Big Island where there's a particular shortage, I think, around Hilo and East Hawaii. So that has been a problem. What Deb Goodwin's lawyer argues, Doug Chin, is that there should be more these cases should go to higher-ups in the department to make sure that they're making the right decisions because they do have such grave repercussions for the people involved.
All right. Well, thanks so much, John. Appreciate the story.
Thank you.
That was Civil Beat's Investigations Editor John Hill with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from First Insurance Company of Hawaii, providing auto insurance since 1911, committed to delivering personal attention and expert advice. First Insurance Company of Hawaii, FICOH.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we went back to the early days of the Oahu Railway and Land Company, specifically to the private railway car built for its founder. The swanky interior of Parlor Observation Car number 64 was finished in oak, mahogany, and bird's eye maple. It came complete with a galley, lavatory, washstand, and sideboard. Designed in classic 19th century parlor car style, it gave visiting dignitaries a taste of Gilded Age luxury as they looked out on the Ewa Plain. At various times, the owner's guests included Queen Liliuokalani and other members of the Hawaiian royal family. This one-of-a-kind memento has been lovingly restored by the Hawaii Railway Society and is still running today. And its original owner, Oahu Railway and Land Company's founder, Benjamin F. Dillingham. And Lee from Kaneohe got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Streetlight Cadence is a local boy band that is definitely going places. Its TV show, We'll Play for Food, was just nominated for an Emmy. Now, they're up against a couple of Hawaii entries, and we'll find out who gets the nod next week at the awards gala in California. We talked to Jonathan Franklin, who plays violin in the foursome, about the upcoming tour and the release of its new album, Momentary.
We're stoked because next month we're going to be on Kauai, Maui, Big Island, and Oahu for our big album release tour, our Momentary tour. Momentary is the title of the new album, and we're just really excited about it. This is going to be the biggest concert series we've had in a really long time.
Now, I have to tell you, I stumbled across your music because I was channel surfing on TV, and I saw your show, We Play for Food.
Yeah, We'll Play for Food. It's been a wild ride. We never thought that was going to actually happen, and then it happened, and then we got to travel the world and street perform around the world, and make a lot of friends and eat a lot of great food.
You know, and you and I were just talking a few minutes ago about just how some of the most incredible performances are really just out there on the street.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes I think attitude, feeling kind of go into places where, I mean, you have to struggle to survive. And I guess the hardest times for us has always been on the sidewalk. And but I mean, you go back, and I mean, Ed Sheeran was a street performer. There's a great lyrics from all kinds of songwriters just talking about those days when they just played for free, and all they could do was just make a little money for change. And I go back to the stories in my mind of when we were just street performers, and like I remember the day that I made enough money to buy a sandwich, and I hadn't eaten for a couple of days, and I'll never forget those moments, and I'll never forget how emotionally I played, because, you know, it was kind of like it was for my food. It felt like life or death. Maybe it wasn't, but it really did feel like it.
But music, I'm sure, is like music for your soul when you play, right?
Yeah. Music is just a way to connect to people. And sometimes you don't have anyone to connect with. And when you go out on the sidewalks, you can connect with a complete stranger, and it's over something that you wouldn't have thought. Like, I remember playing classical music when I first started street performing, and someone would walk up to me and said, I used to play violin when I was little, or my daughter plays violin, and that reminds me of my daughter, or just really special moments. And then they'd put $5 in your case, and then, you know, life was good. But it was always amazing to connect with people over any kind of music, just on the sidewalks.
And I love, because I know when I was traveling in London, they have special places in the subway, you know, where the musicians get special permits, and that's their spot.
Yeah.
And it's pretty cool.
Los Angeles is the same way. There's places like Third Street Promenade where you can only play in this particular area, and you have to be a certain amount of distance away from the next person. And there's some sort of regulation, because on the sidewalks, let's face it, there's always someone who's not all there, and they're trying to step on your territory, so to say, to just play music. But having regulations in place are really nice.
And so, like, what are some of your memories of playing out on the streets in Waikiki?
Oh, man. One of my favorite ones, we used to play in front of Yogurtland when it was still there, about a block Diamond Head side of the Duke statue. And we got pretty good, you know, after playing on the sidewalks for years as a band. The audiences got bigger. Like, say it was a Friday night and tourist season, there was just lots of people on the sidewalk. And we probably had 100 people just crowding the streets, and they were clapping and applauding, and there was just a lot of fun. And someone in the condo on, I think, like the 9th or 10th floor was trying to sleep. They had an early morning, I'm sure. And so they called the police for a noise complaint, and a police officer shows up, and he stands in the back, and he just watches for one song, two two songs, three songs. And he finally comes up to us and he said, "Hey, we got a noise complaint. But honestly, I didn't hear any noise." And he walked away, and it was just the most endearing thing, and I've always been encouraged by that ever since.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty incredible. I mean, and too, when you think the folks that have made it, that started on the streets in Waikiki, you know, Bruno Mars, yeah, and Taimani Gardner, I mean, you name it. And so it was fun, like I said, that I discovered you on TV. I didn't see you out on the streets, but I'm just really thrilled that you folks are doing well.
Well, thank you for the love. We're stoked that someone watches the TV show.
Okay. Well, now, so your band has relocated to L.A.
That's right. We thought it was necessary to keep pushing ourselves. We've always been goal setters in the band. When it was on the sidewalks, I remember the first time we made like $50. And we said, okay, well, what's the next goal? Let's try to make $100. And so we changed up our set list, and we dressed a different way, and we said different things, and we just experimented till it worked. And I remember we made like $97 and a bunch of change, and we counted that change, and it just barely broke 100, and we just jumped up, and we screamed, and it was awesome. And then fast forward, we're like, okay, can we win this battle of the bands? And then when we did that, we're like, okay, what do you do now? Let's make a record. Let's submit it for the Nahoku Hano Hano Awards. And we didn't expect to win, but then we won. And then we're like, well, what do you do now? I guess we should try doing it again. Let's do a bigger Kickstarter campaign. Let's try to submit again. And then we won that again. And then we had all these really great gigs around the island, but we didn't feel like we could go much further locally. So the next thing to do is to take the next challenge. The next goal was to try and figure out how to win a Grammy. And in the process of trying to figure that out, we got the opportunity to make a TV show. And so that's what we're doing right now. And maybe one day, long down the road, we could get nominated for a Grammy. But on accident, instead, we got nominated for an Emmy for the show, which is kind of roundabout, but
yeah, go figure.
We'll take it, you know.
Of the places that you've been to, you know, because I caught the one about Japan and New York.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, what was the takeaway for you as you played in all these different places?
You know, we've done street performing across the world before, and it was always really just to see if we could do it. That was one of our goals when we were, when we decided at first to be a professional band. We said, what do professional bands do? And we said, they go on tour, and we didn't know what that looked like, and no one knew who we were, and we didn't have a decent press kit, so no one booked us at any shows. So ultimately, we found ourselves in major cities across the world, and we had to street perform to pay for groceries, like, and a meal, and to get to the next city to pay for gas. You know, we had to cover our expenses. And it was surprisingly successful. It seemed like everywhere we went, the vibe was the same. People appreciated it. And in places where we made less money, there was just more people to take care of us. And the places where we made a lot of money, we got to splurge and just eat the fanciest food we could. It was a really great time in our lives. And so fast forward 5 or 6 years later, the TV show is really just a remake of what we've done, except in new places with new people. And it's really just going back and kind of reliving those days, but in just reality. I'm really stoked because most of our time is spent in a garage recording music or playing at places that have stages. But I kind of enjoy the moments where you don't know what to expect.
Right.
And you don't know if you're going to make enough money to get through the day. And it's a really cool thing to just kind of relive those days.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't catch you on the street, and I haven't caught any of your concerts, but, you know, I did catch the TV show. So, you know, that medium is introducing you to a different audience.
Yeah.
And so you have a number of I guess singles coming out, right?
Oh yeah, we've got a whole album coming out. Momentary is the title, and this record is about, I guess, those moments in life that forever affect you. And a lot of it's pretty heavy. The topics, some of our friends who've died or have shaped our lives in such a way, but over just a brief moment. And we're really, really proud of it, mostly because we've done it all ourselves. Most of the time, we've always gone to the studio and we've always paid for someone to record because we didn't have the tools, the microphones, but we decided that this is the one we're going to attempt to make on our own, and we're just stoked with how it came out, and we're just really proud of ourselves. And, you know, it might not be, like, up to, like, Grammy Award-winning producers, but the fact
you never know.
But the fact that we did it ourselves just means a lot to us, and I think it means a lot for our future as a band, because next time we need to make a song for some reason, we don't have to pay a couple $1,000s to get it done. Instead, we can just do it in our garage, and we'll have a new song. And that means we can make more content regularly, faster. And I don't think we could be more stoked on this album.
Okay, so you're a garage band, and let's listen to the cut. And what's the name of it?
This one's called Vinyl Records. It's about just holding a disc from the past, I guess. You know, a vinyl record is literally a wheel of music. And I grew up in the MP3 era, where I never held on to music in that kind of way. And someone gave me a vinyl record pretty recently, and I was like, this is so cool. So this is Vinyl Records.
Sometimes I turn off the radio, oh, oh, and go back to a time before, and I play a vinyl record. Needle on a wheel of time, I play those vinyl records. Go back to where you were mine, I play those vinyl records. Spin it like we did before our time was up.
I like it.
No, thanks. thanks. There's a lot that you'll probably like on the new album. I think you'll enjoy it.
Gosh, so then the concerts that you have coming up, you know, you're going to fly back to L.A. after
right.
this interview.
That's right. And then we're back for Kauai. We're playing at Anaina Ho on North Shore on the 21st of June. We're playing at the Republic on the 27th here. The Mac is on the 28th. And the Kahilu Theater on Big Island is on the 29th. And for those of you musicians and songwriters and anyone who wants to like learn anything about the music industry, the Hawaii Songwriting Festival is one of the most incredible things you can participate in. So really, if anyone's looking to make music, if you're street performers like us, one of our previous band members encouraged us to show up, and we found enough money from them from playing on the sidewalks, and we just showed up, and we didn't have a place to stay, but instead we just found all the love in the world. And we learned how to actually be professional musicians. And that was the transition between us being street performers and, I feel like, professional businessmen in this music industry.
And so when is that normally?
The Hawaii Songwriting Festival is June 20th through the 22nd. So it's coming up. Like, really, I couldn't encourage it more. Like, we've got to hang out with incredible people like Kenny Loggins. I was mentored by Kenny Loggins for like a good hour. He was just a really great
I'm
guy.
I'm jealous.
You know, we got to hang out with Jason Mraz, and just we're sitting in a room together and they're criticizing your songs, but in the best way. They're like, oh, I feel like this will change the mood by just changing that chord. Or I think that lyric means something different than you think it means. And it's just a really, really special experience. I couldn't encourage it more.
Okay, well, thanks for spending time with us. And just real quick, shout out to your band members. And what are their day jobs?
Oh, this is it. This is really our day job. We do everything music. We street perform. We play at Disneyland. We play at Universal. And we go on tour, and we do our best to make enough in merchandise. And if anyone buys CDs, we still have CDs for sale. And we hope to have vinyl records on this new album. You know, we have every kind of business plan in place. Oh, and if you are interested in working with us on the next season of the TV show, please get in touch with us. Streetlightcadence.com is how you find us.
Okay. And who are your band members?
My band members, Brian Webb is on the cello. Jesse Shiroma is on the accordion. Benjamin Chai is on the drums or guitar, just depending on the song. And then I'm Jonathan, and I play the violin, and everybody sings.
Awesome. And no day jobs. I'm impressed.
Yeah. No, it means we're poor, but it's a good life.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Jonathan Franklin of Streetlight Cadence. For the pop band's full tour schedule, go to our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
So if you love me, won't you say so? You're dreaming of, or am I the one you're deceiving? Take all of me, or set me free, 'cause I don't know what to believe.
Well, that wraps it up for today. Up tomorrow, protecting precious viewplanes, why the city wants your input. Tell us what's on your mind. Caller Talk Backline, record your 2 cents. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.